Politicians and voters may hate crime, but American audiences can't get enough of shows like CSI or Law & Order. This week, we're joined by an Emmy-winning filmmaker who has intimately chronicled some of America's most notorious criminals. He's Mark Smerling, this week on Storying the Public Square. Hello and welcome. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. This week's guest is Mark Smerling, who won the 2015 Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Documentary Series for The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. He was also an Academy Award nominee for Capturing the Freedmans. His most recent project is the groundbreaking podcast from Gimlet Media, Crime Town, which reached number one on the iTunes chart and topped international lists when it debuted last year. Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the road that you traveled that led to debuting as America's most popular podcast.
After we got done with The Jinx, Zach, my partner, and I, he was the editor on The Jinx, you know, we were burned out a little bit, and we were kind of looking around and trying to figure out how to tell an expansive crime story, but not get involved in a huge television venture right then. And we met Alex. Zach had a relationship with Alex Bloomberg, who's the president and the co-founder of Gimlet. And he suggested we do a podcast. And immediately I thought of Providence.
Well, did he leave it open to you? Just do a podcast and come up with an idea?
Yeah, well, originally we brought him in because there was so much great audio material on The Jinx, you know, that we didn't use. There were wiretaps and phone conversations from prison, and there was all that extra audio from the trial down in Galveston, Texas. We thought that would make an interesting podcast. We played a bunch of it, and he thought it was interesting too, but The Jinx at that point had gotten to a point where he didn't feel like he needed to make another thing about The Jinx. So we went to lunch, and he said, just make a podcast.
And so what drew you to Providence?
I have history here. I met Buddy probably around 1984, 1985.
You're talking about former Providence Mayor Buddy Cianci.
Yeah, of course. Is there another Buddy?
Well.
So I met him at the Biltmore Hotel. He was at the end of the bar. My father-in-law, who's from Rhode Island, he introduced me to him. And, you know, at that point in my life, I was sort of in flux. I didn't know if I was going to go to film school. I was going to continue to work in newspapers. And, you know, I torture myself pretty well. So Buddy is a great guy to talk to if he shines his light on you. And I was young. I was probably 19, 18 years old. And, you know, he just shined all over me. And we talked for about 40 minutes. And I felt like I had made a decision. And he had an influence on my life.
Wow.
And,
wow.
And then I left. And, you know, I, of course, followed him because he's a very charismatic guy.
Yeah.
And he could make you feel like you were the center of the earth. Then soon after that, the incident at Power Street happened, the kidnapping and assault. And he lost his mayorship. And then, you know, I thought that was probably going to be the last time I see him until I come back to see my father-in-law. And then he came back, you know. And he would pop up. He was on the radio. And,
yeah.
You know, I would hear about him. And then when I came back, he was at my mother-in-law's funeral. It's Providence, you know.
Yeah.
There's 6 degrees of separation in most places. It's 2 degrees of separation.
So for our listeners and viewers, some of whom maybe those two or three may not have listened to Crime Town. Who are some of the other major characters in Crime Town? You've talked about Buddy Cianci, the late mayor of Providence, convicted felon and individual. Who else do you focus on?
There's Jerry Tillinghast, who was a mob enforcer under Raymond Patriarca back in the 70s when he got out of the home from the Vietnam War. He sort of joined a crew headed by Gerard Wimette. He's a returning character in it. He goes to prison in episode 6, So he disappears from the episode's end. There's Bobby Wallison, another mob enforcer, who at 16 years old was the youngest kid ever put into the adult correctional institutions. And he is going to be weaving throughout until episode 9. There's Charles the Ghost Kennedy, who is started out as sort of Wimette's bookmaker and his assistant, and ended up being one of the biggest drug dealers on the East Coast, and he went away for 16 years on a continuing criminal enterprise. He starts in the last episode, which was 8, and he's gonna weave his way through the end. And there's a couple other people who go in and out of it. There's not just criminals, there's politicians, there's all kinds of people, doctors, and there's all kinds of interesting people, but they all intersect this world of Buddy and Raymond Patriarca.
Who was, of course, the late mob boss.
Right.
So let's take a moment here and listen to a clip.
Sure.
See, we get two governments in this country. We get the United States government, and we get the government of crime.
He says, you know, I think I'm going to run for mayor. Either that or I'm going to buy a boat.
If you're going to be bad, be good at it. If you're going to be good, be good. If you're going to be bad, you have to be good at it, because there's no in between.
I announce my candidacy for mayor of the city of Providence.
So, Mark, what does the story of a corrupt mayor and a former mafia boss tell us about the American about American law enforcement and about American society more broadly?
Well, you have to realize that this story takes place from the 70s. It comes up to 2000, 2001, but it's a different time. So what it says about that time, I think, is that in Rhode Island, and I think Rhode Island's unique in this way, there was a sort of closeness in the populace, intermingling relationships, family relationships, and friendships that allowed corruption to happen in the state house and in the mayor's office, but also, you know, protected criminals at some level who were coming out of Patriarca's crime family on Federal Hill. And that went on for quite a while until the state police moved out of the city of Providence and started to create a special investigations unit that was going to have to deal with it, and the feds came in and that all went away for the most part.
So a lot of the story is unique to Providence, Rhode Island, but I think there are parts of it, sort of the essence of it, that could apply to other cities and even on a federal level. I mean, talk about that a little bit. What happened here was unique in its individual characteristics.
Yeah.
But the themes are hardly unique.
No. I mean, the themes of corruption that happened here happened in many cities, because cities seem to be more, from my perspective, seem to be more open to the idea of corruption because of the way the politics works in cities, a democratic machine, which was a machine that was born to take care of the working man, ended up sort of becoming extremely corrupt over a long period of time because the election process is fueled by that machine. So jobs become part of getting votes, and you know, buying tickets to raffles become part of getting votes, and everything sort of mixes up into what is real and what is corrupt and what is for the good of the city. But so that was happening in New York, that was happening in Chicago, that was happening in many American cities. It's interesting, it didn't happen in Denver, Colorado, or in Wyoming, and some of the Western cities sort of skipped over that, but certainly the Eastern Democratic cities were affected by that.
I'm curious, you had tremendous success in getting people to talk to you. You've got archival audio as well, but you also have a lot of first-person interviews with people. Why are people willing to talk?
I think at some point everybody wants to tell their story. You know, if you come to the story at the right time and you promise that you're going to be transparent about how you deal with their story and talk to them, and you can get them to be transparent with you, people want to tell their stories. Nobody wants to leave this earth without having some legacy. And I think that a lot of these people had come to a point in their lives where they thought telling their stories was a good idea.
So just talk for a second about craft.
Right.
There's a large cast of characters here. Many of them, certainly some of them, had never opened up to anyone outside of the courts or their fellow citizens and people in their circle. How do you approach these people? How do you get them to share their stories? I mean, this isn't like going to, I don't know, stopping someone on the street and saying, what do you think about the weather? You know, the man on the street thing. There had to be a whole fairly sophisticated approach here.
Yeah. Well, usually you meet people through other people. You know, this didn't originally go to Gimlet. It was suggested by Gimlet, but I didn't know if I wanted to do a podcast. So I came up to Providence with my recorder, Zach, and we just started talking to people. And one of the first people we spoke to was Bill Malinowski, who is a Providence Journal reporter, a crime reporter, sort of a great crime reporter. And he introduced us to Charles, and Charles introduced us to Tony Fiore, and it kind of went like that. And then you're just, you know, you're in the process of making a relationship. I have a very high-class problem, which is it takes me 2 or 3 years to make anything. So I have the time to put into the relationship. When I used to work on newspapers, or I used to work, you know, for broadcast television, everything had to be done in 48 hours or a week was like a lot of time. But I spend a tremendous amount of time with these people. They become, I have a relationship with them that's probably as much of a relationship that anybody has with anybody who is their friend in some ways. You become close with them.
The time you put in certainly was rewarded. I think you told me before we went on air here that you've had almost 6 million downloads of this podcast, which is extraordinary success by any measure.
Yeah.
So the time was worth it.
You mentioned legendary Providence Journal reporter Bill Malinowski. You rely on journalists for a fair amount of information, backstory, detail. I'm assuming other research help was along the way as well. Are you saying something in this era of fake news and media suspicion about the value of that sort of local beat reporter that maybe we're missing in the national dialogue?
Well, I think the news has become a commodity like everything else in America, you know, and more so than it's ever been before. I think politics has become a commodity, you know. So we live in a time now where everything is commoditized. And the internet, and this is very, you know, high-end stuff, I'm thinking.
We like high-end.
Yeah. The internet has not helped. And I think that it's hurt the news business. And I understand to some extent the suspicion that some people have with media. I'm no fan of Gawker and what they do. I understand the importance of the First Amendment. I understand that's impenetrable. But I also understand that making news a commodity should have its limits. You know, in the work we do, we get criticized every once in a while because we use sound effects, we use music, we heighten the drama through editing. We're using basic television storytelling structure, and we're applying that to documentary by maybe taking the end and putting it on the beginning so that you understand there's some imperative. You're heading to some place, we're pushing information back. We're using a lot of tricks, but we're not twisting the story so it breaks. You know, and we're letting people tell their stories, I think, in a transparent way, and we're very sensitive to that.
So we got to take a station break in a second, but before we do, I want to just ask you very quickly: So you're not a journalist, but you are using the journalistic techniques. So how do you know the line that you're trying to draw between the two? Because there are storytelling devices that you're using, as you mentioned, from television. That are different than you would if you were doing a straight documentary, I assume.
Not really. I think we are journalists, and I think we're documentary filmmakers in the base sense of the word. I think we're constantly trying to lift the genre. Okay. We're not ignoring the desires of the audience, but we're not twisting the story so much so the audience is getting something that's false. You know, so I think it's at the end of the day, the storyteller is the arbiter of their own truth. So if you're not an honest storyteller, then the audience figures that out very quickly. And you could see many instances in the last 5 years where the audience has been very punitive.
About that. Yeah. Well, we do have to take a station break. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. We're produced at the studios of Rhode Island PBS and can be heard 4 times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's The POTUS Channel, 124. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. We're talking with Mark Smerling, an Emmy-winning filmmaker, gifted storyteller, and part of the team currently bringing us a view of the intersection of civil society and crime in the groundbreaking podcast Crime Town. Mark, so, you know, we've talked a little bit about the news environment, the media environment. We've talked a lot about sort of Crime Town. There's a story about crime and criminality in the United States today that is part of the public dialogue. And we heard President Trump recently say that if Chicago didn't clean up its mess, he was going to send the feds in. What do you think the narrative about crime is, and how does that mesh with reality in public life?
Yeah, well, I think that America's got a very unfortunate relationship with crime. We glamorize it. And we love it at some level, but we do not have a way of dealing with it that is, I think, progressive, you know, particularly when it comes to criminals. And obviously, I am dealing with a lot of criminals. I mean, since I've always done crime, since capturing the Freedmans. And people who are out of prison, they, you know, it's very difficult for them to find jobs, almost impossible. There's no rehabilitation. There's no such thing. Our prison system is, in my opinion, bankrupt. It's not designed in any way to make life better for anybody. Yeah. It's just completely punitive. So when people get out, it's not surprising that they return to crime, or they're dysfunctional and they become wards of the state. We're not doing a very good job dealing with our crime. And my personal experience is, you know, that the people that I've met, Jerry Tillinghast, for example, who has a job through the largesse of family and is good at it, and he gets up every morning, he's been promoted, you know, and he wants to do something with his life now that is meaningful for his grandchildren. He's the exception to the rule. You know, a lot of these guys, they end up in public housing in some ways. Yeah. They would like to work, but if you're a guy who went to prison on a drug charge for 16 years and you go to get a job and that's on your resume, it's impossible.
And the American experience with the judicial system and the prison system in particular stands in stark contrast with most of the rest of the industrialized world.
Yeah.
A very good point, and I want to follow up on that. How do you think this country got to that situation? I mean, you gave a spot-on description of the prison system and what happens after you leave prison. Did it arise from the Puritan founders of parts of this country? How did we get here? As Jim said, many other countries are very different.
Yeah.
They try to take people who have done wrong and make them do right and give them a chance.
Right.
We do exactly the opposite. It's kind of like, I can't use the word, but you know what
we're
saying.
Creating factories for criminals. We're creating a machine that's going to create criminals. You know, we're not creating a machine that's taking in young men, particularly black men, who on small charges, putting them into this machine, they come out much more hardened criminals than they went in. Yeah. You know, and I think that comes from this idea of, you know, punishment in this country and our inability to let ourselves spend money in a significant way to deal with people who may have issues. You know, you see that in the healthcare system as well.
Mental health, too, of course.
We as a country have made a decision that those people do not have the same value as people who work and create families and create income and create industry. Yeah. We see them as disposable. So, unfortunately, that's how we've been treating them. And that's been going on for quite a while.
Is there a way to use storytelling, though, to change the public perception of that story?
Every story I tell is trying to change the public perception, because what I try to do is pull the veneer of the criminal back to show the human being underneath.
And you, in Crime Town, it's absolutely remarkable. And there's time in the yard at the maximum security prison in Rhode Island where you get a glimpse of how prison life is contributing to the furthering of people's criminal careers.
Yeah.
You know, so we mentioned the Trump administration, and I'm curious, if you were to do a podcast about the earliest days of the Trump administration, is there a storyline that sort of stands out in your mind?
Well, it's people on the internet right now on Twitter are saying that Buddy and the story of Buddy in Crime Town, they're comparing it to the Trump story. Yeah. I don't know if that's true. I don't know. You know, I'd like to give him more of a benefit, the benefit of doubt, than I think most because I would like to hope that there's going to be something good that comes out of this. But I mean, I'm getting suggestions via the internet to maybe the next season of Crime Town should be Crime Town Washington.
We'll have 12 million downloads at this point.
And I'm not so sure that story is ready to be told.
Yeah,
you know? Probably not. Probably too early. Not too early. Not too early. I want to return to Kraft again. Hmm. You began as a journalist. You then got into screen work, a lot of great work. Journalism is text. Screen is a lot of images, also sound. Now you're working in a medium where you have no images and you have no text.
Yeah.
You're dealing entirely with audio, sound. Was that a hard transition for you?
Yes. I mean, we didn't mention this, but I was nominated for an Emmy for The Jinx in cinematography. I shot it as well.
So that's really your world prior to this.
That's where I came, and it was a little of a chore because in visual storytelling, there's cues, visual cues, that you use to tell the audience where they are, who's speaking, what's happening, you know, what's going on, what time of day it is, you know, all that stuff, you know. In audio storytelling, you have crickets, you know. Yeah. You can't hear the sunrise, you know, but you can hear the car drive by. But most importantly, I think when people are talking, the big lesson is you can't have multiple people talking next to each other because you can't discern who's talking. And if you start IDing people through the narration, it gets very labored. So you tend to let people talk a little longer. Whereas in documentaries that I've seen on television, some I've done, you're cutting back and forth from people very quickly. That doesn't tend to happen in audio storytelling and podcasting.
So I'm curious, with that background, what attracted you to podcasting in the first place?
Two things. The chance to tell an expansive story without a studio hanging over my shoulder and watching it. Honestly, the chance to own it, you know, and not have to give everything away, you know, because I knew it was going to be a lot of work. But I think the most important thing is it was a challenge to tell the story in audio. If you listen to Crime Town, there's a lot of cinema in Crime Town, even though there's no visual. There's still scene building, and there's still audio cues that get you into the scene. You hear things that bring the scene to the foreground. Rather than just having people talk, you're hearing things in the background and wiretaps. There's a lot of source material.
Yeah.
And I think that was going to be the challenge that made it worth it.
You know, so you mentioned the source material. As I listened to that, so my background is a historian. I'm used to sort of working with a lot of different documentary evidence and having a rough idea of the story that I need to tell before I even start writing. In an audio environment, is it a similar process? Do you know what the narrative arc is going to be, or does it unfold to you as you're going through it, or something in between?
It's sort of like that scene in A Beautiful Mind where you have all this stuff. We have boards.
The pattern
big
starts.
The pattern starts to appear. We have whiteboards. So
whiteboards, okay.
And we're constantly working off whiteboards and cue cards that we paste up, you know, those little tiny index cards. And we're constantly trying to move things around in the grand way, you know, in the big ways, the big moves to try to map it out. And then we get into it, and it's about sort of taking away the stuff that's not telling the story well and trying to find the connection points between the episodes. So you're looking for, I was saying just before that you're looking for the best thing is a good story. Somebody tells you a good story, and it falls into the timeline of events that you're trying to tell your grander story about. The better thing is he tells a good story that connects to another story later in your series. So now you're trying to connect all the dots. And that process is not just a process of good storytelling. It's a process of discovering what really happened, you know, in the story, how these things connected with each other and how these events took place and what ultimately happened is because of this, this, and this.
But you know, so it's a 20 episode series.
Mm-hmm.
You're still producing.
Mm-hmm.
So is this a case of you start building the bridge and hope that it gets to the end
before
you're done, or you know where it's going?
We know where it's going.
So you knew that, did you know that from episode one or even before?
We had a rough out. Now that's changed. As things have developed, we've gotten interviews that changed it. We've learned about things that have changed it, but we had a rough out that was...
So where do you actually produce this? And talk a little bit, you work with a very accomplished crew too, as well. So talk a little about that.
Yeah, we produce it out of Brooklyn, and Gimlet Media's in Brooklyn. my partner is, I couldn't do it without him, Zach Bontier, who you've met. He's an incredible storyteller and a great technician as far as just making everything sing in the right note, you know, because there's layers of audio that are going on. And we have a couple writers, Drew Nellis and Austin Mitchell. We just took on somebody new who used to be on Startup, Caitlin Roberts. You know, that's it. That's all we got.
But this is a frenzied process. I mean, it's you've crazy. Talked to me. This is like 7 days a week.
It's
like
7 days a
hello.
Week.
Hello.
Yeah, those guys
crazy,
are working 12, 14-hour days
wow.
sometime. We are always up against a deadline. Very sorry that we're sometimes late.
Like you see your journalism Twitter. Training helped yeah. With yeah. the deadline part.
Yeah, well, sometimes a deadline sharpens your pencil. So, you know, it's just part of
That's a good
it.
Point, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, we've got about a minute and a half left here. What's the future of podcasting? Is this is in some respects, I think Wayne came up with this, so I don't want to take complete credit for the insight, but it's a little bit like Back to the Future in the sense of the return of audio programming with the wide market.
You can think of like radio theater
yeah.
of the 30s and 40s, very much.
Where do you think this as a medium, this is headed, particularly in the realm of storytelling?
I'll tell you the story why I did, another reason I did the podcast. I was in Los Angeles, I was gonna go do meetings. I went to the Hertz checkout counter and I wanted to try a Chevy Volt.
Yeah.
You know, so I got a Chevy Volt and in the dashboard they have basically what is your iPhone. You know, I think it's called iCar.
Yeah.
And I saw the podcast button there, which I use constantly. And I thought to myself, there's gonna be an intersection of radio and podcasting that's inevitable.
Yeah.
And it's gonna be a matter of trying to figure out how to deliver, just like the cable television yeah. networks did, how to deliver that medium, that stuff, on this platform, podcasts, to the audience in a way that they can find what they're looking for in an efficient manner. And I knew Apple was working on that diligently. And I think that there's gonna be a crossover. You know, Sirius is a good example of another alternative radio format
yeah.
that's digital, that has how many stations, 500, 600
Hundreds,
stations?
Yeah,
I mean, 1,000, I don't know
yeah.
what it is. But I think what Apple's doing right is they're putting the buttons in the right place so people can get, and they're suggesting things, and you're going to get to a place, I think, where you'll be able to get what you want and hear what you want. So that's going to expand the value of the stuff that we're putting on radio.
It's tremendous. It's tremendous. We've got to leave it there. He's
okay.
Mark Smerling. The podcast is Crime Town. To learn more about Story in the Public Square, please find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit our website at pellcenter.org. For Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. We hope you'll see you next week.